sometimes a little more. My Bloody Podcast.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, boils and ghouls. It's My Bloody Podcast time, and we are so excited to be here at the end of January. We were talking about all the good horror movies coming out, talking about vintage ones, bloody questions, bloody recommendations, new horror news. I'm Brian Kluger, and I am joined by the fantastic fest man himself, the horror aficionado of the universe, Preston Barta. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well. God damn, you're giving me like really good titles each week. I don't know if I can live up to horror aficionado of the universe.
You're getting
quite the horror fan.
You are quite the horror fan. I would say you're a horror aficionado.
I'm your Padawan, and you're teaching me, Obi.
Oh, thank you. We're using the Force, the Jedi mind trick, into you loving horror. And that's what we're trying to do with all of you people listening out there to get into this horror genre, because it's so much fun. Oh, we have a great show for you today on iTunes and Stitcher Radio, Google Play, everything else. My Bloody Podcast. We're going to be talking about the 1995 horror sci-fi thriller film starring the amazing... Actually starring, I think, Preston's best friend, Peter Weller.
Yeah.
They're besties right now. I think they share necklaces and bracelets and shit. But it's called Screamers, if you remember that movie. We're going to be diving balls deep into that film. And we have questions and recommendations that are going to be quite fun for you today. But first... we have some news to talk about. Our first bit of news comes actually, it's kind of like a shitty piece of news, and because I just don't understand how this is going to be good at all. But the CW, the same people who did like Pretty Little Liars and all that shit, has ordered a pilot episode of the Lost Boys TV series. So we all know 1987's Lost Boys is one of the perfect movies of all time. Vampire speaking. It's got Bill from Bill and Ted, Kiefer Sutherland, Jason Patrick, Corey Haim, Corey Feldman. It's just so good. And now CW is going to fuck it all up, I think. So, Preston, your thoughts?
Yeah, I'm right there with you. I don't know if we mentioned it before, but a couple of years ago, two or three years ago, they were working on getting a pilot going for this. That was written by Rob Thomas, the guy behind Veronica Mars, but it got put on hold. And so now it's the pilot's being ordered and it's being rewritten by one of the ladies that's behind Scandal and Grey's Anatomy. Heather Mitchell. And so, yeah, it's going to be on the CW, so that's not super promising. And a lot of the comments that have been circulating on the internet have been pretty upset about that fact. So,
yeah, I
wish I could truly say I still believe in this situation, but I don't.
I still believe, shirtless sax guy. So Rob Thomas, not the singer, but Rob Thomas gave us Veronica Mars,
Xbox
which is
20.
Goddamn good. And Rob Thomas supposedly is rebooting Veronica Mars, which I don't like because, I mean, I'm such a fan of Kristen Bell in that role. But supposedly Rob Thomas is all in for this Hulu Veronica Mars reboot. But if Rob Thomas gave us Veronica Mars, I don't know how hands-on he's going to be with this Lost Boys show, which like there's like a slight glimmer of hope there, but it's just all squashed with this Heather Mitchell stuff and CW, and I just
I think the glimmer of hope is that there's always hope that a network can try and reinvent themselves in a way, because they're being put in this box and we're expecting that that's what all the material that they're going to churn out is going to be like. And so I hope that this is one of those very rare cases where it just seems like, for instance, I think the thing, first thing that comes to my mind is this TV show that's no longer on, but I saw it at South by probably like 5, 4, 3 years ago, somewhere in there, called Unreal. And it was basically giving you like the behind the scenes of a reality TV show a la The Bachelor or The Bachelorette. And I was not expecting a TV show to be as dark and truthful and realistic as it was. It felt like an HBO show, but it was owned and produced by Lifetime, which was insane to me. So there's still that possibility that something like that could happen with this TV show, but that's just really reaching out. So I doubt it, but, you know, I can't really give my full opinion until I see some material, start seeing shots. I don't know. Just like the idea of a Lost Boys TV show not having grand effects and plenty of time to produce something that might have a better life on Netflix or Hulu or something like that, that has the money to back it. But you know, we'll see how it goes. But I'll hold out until I start seeing actual clips and trailers for it.
True, because there's like 5 movies of Lost Boys, and Corey Feldman ain't doing shit, so maybe he could be part of this. I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. I haven't, you know, I've honestly never seen any of the sequels.
I saw the second one, and it was terrible. And they did a comic book series, and I read those, and they weren't that good. But yeah, there yeah. You go. Lost Boys 1. That'll always be there. But yeah. We'll update you as stuff comes along with this. Moving on, want to talk about. So, have you heard of Salad Fingers before, Preston?
I've seen the image around the internet in some places, never looked into it, so this is all you have no idea.
Okay, so if you go to YouTube and you type in Salad Fingers, you're going to see a bunch of web videos of this animated character creature named Salad Fingers. And Salad Fingers is just a very super creepy horror character that you just have to see to believe, because there's some really dark shit in here. There is going to be a brand new episode. The creator, David Firth, who has a great but twisted mind, is bringing back Salad Fingers for a brand new, the longest video yet. There has not been a new video since 2013. That's how long Jeez. It's been. But it is, I highly recommend you watch Salad Fingers if you're a fan of horror, because it's just, you're gonna see it, and it's gonna stay in your mind. It's so super weird and creepy and scary and funny at the same time. But yes, check out Salad Fingers. You're gonna want to do it. Trust me.
Is it like one of those like late night Cartoon Network kind of things? Not, but that kind of feel.
Yes, it is. I'm actually surprised like Cartoon Network hasn't picked this up. Maybe it's too much for them, but I've seen Cartoon Network late night shit, and I would imagine this would be right up their alley, because it is just, it's gross, and it's, you watch it and you're just like, I feel dirty and weird, and it's creepy, and I'm going to be thinking about it. But I'm very excited, because I've been a fan of Salad Fingers for a long time. So if you know that, like, if you know me, you know what to kind of expect if I'm a fan of something weird and crazy like this. So Salad Fingers, yes, Preston, I hope you give it a shot.
All right.
Moving on, another bit of news. The original Pet Sematary is coming to 4K, which is awesome. 4K Ultra HD in March, which is pretty awesome. We've received Evil Dead 1 and Evil Dead 2 on 4K and the original Halloween on 4K. Pet Sematary now is the next one, and that is pretty awesome. I'm very excited. It's releasing March 26th for its 30th anniversary. Are you excited for this?
Yeah. There's new extras on it, which is exciting. They have director Mary Lambert coming back to do... I don't know if it's necessarily, it might be a new commentary, but it, you know, like with, Shout Factory and Scream Factory, you go on their website, they say new, so you know exactly right away. But, from here, it just, I can gather that they're doing, a few new featurettes with new interviews with her and where she talks about maybe some of her favorite memories doing the film. There's some never before seen storyboards and behind the scenes image galleries. So, which is cool because they're all on the 4K disc too, which often a lot of the new or retro releases that they do on 4K, you'll just get the movie on one disc and the Blu-ray has all the features. But so it's exciting that they have new features that will be included on the 4K itself.
Yeah.
And really badass cover art, too, I have to say.
So I'm trying to think, is that the actual cover art or is that the UK cover art? Because I'm not
I sure. think, yeah, because I've seen the UK cover art. It might have been like a special steelbook release that I saw from somebody that I follow on Instagram called Dawn of Discs. And so he released this really cool artwork for the UK version, but I'm pretty positive that the one that's on the internet right now with the cat being part of the underground part of the graveyard, the cemetery itself, I think that's what we'll see in the US.
Cool. Yeah, no, I'm super excited about this. Yeah, and it looks like Paramount and the director Mary Lambert are working together with Diabolik to release this. So very exciting.
Yeah.
Very, very exciting. So yes, look out for Pet Sematary on 4K coming soon, which is really cool because now we're seeing like Halloween, Evil Dead, Evil Dead 2, Pet Sematary releasing on 4K. It just means that Preston soon, your favorite reanimator probably will be coming to 4K.
God, I hope so. yeah, well, it's cool because, you know, some of these remakes that are coming out this year, like Pet Sematary, Hellboy, they're all getting 4K. The originals are getting 4K released. Like Hellboy's getting one in March, too, I believe.
Yeah, super excited. So, yeah, that's that bit of news. We're going to move on to something really crazy, which I guess we're going to figure out if we would do this. There is a Sweden film festival, the Göteborg Film Festival in Sweden, which starts this weekend, are offering up screenings of a movie, a post-apocalyptic sci-fi film called Anaria? Aniara, and it's going to this screen in an actual coffin with speakers, outfitted screens for the coffin, and air vents. So this is kind of crazy. This is like taking it to like 10D, like screw the chairs that shoot like mist at you. This is some scary shit. I don't know if I could do this.
I would do it. I think this sounds like something, I don't know if, I mean, you have to sign some serious waivers and there'd be a lot of trust issues there thinking that I was like, can this, you know, this coffin wheel away? Is it in the ground? I would like to see it nailed to the ground. I don't want to be transported somewhere. You get out of the movie. Once the movie's over, you open the coffin, you get out and you're like, what the fuck am I? Yeah, that'd be scary. So, yeah, I would need some assurance and to do this, but it sounds like something that like, Alamo Drafthouse might do, but then again, I don't know if they would go to that sort of level. Maybe they would screen like a movie like Buried with Ryan Reynolds and show it inside an actual coffin.
That would be cool. Cause I remember at Fantastic Fest one year, we got to get in a coffin
for
virtual reality. But with this film festival in this coffin, there's actually going to be a panic button for anyone who gets too scared, which is, I guess, good. But it's a cool idea. I don't know, how long is this movie? Is it like 3 hours or is it 70 brisk minutes? I don't know.
Yeah, I guess it depends how good the film is too.
And you know, like, so the film says it's about a spaceship carrying settlers to Mars is knocked off course, causing the consumption-obsessed passengers to consider their place in the universe. Which I guess if you're in a spaceship, you know, that's kind of confined, but not a coffin. Like, I would imagine watching something like Buried with Ryan Reynolds, like Preston said, and then, like, having a simulated sound of dirt being poured on top of you. Like, I don't...
Yeah, just having somebody out there that's, like, banging on the actual coffin.
So you would do this. You would sign up for this.
Yeah, I would do it. If they had it at, like, Fantastic Fest or something like that, maybe it does well over there. They're like, okay, let's take this on tour, and they bring it to Fantastic Fest or maybe a Midnighter at South By. I don't know if they'd do that, but maybe. Yeah, I would do it. Yeah, I'm feeling adventurous, so I'll take on the danger.
That sounds like fun, and it sounds scary as shit. I mean, you're in there, and I wonder, like, because, like, in a coffin, how far is the screen from your face? Like, it's got to be, at the most 8 inches probably, away from your face? I mean, that's pretty close to be watching the screen.
Yeah.
Or if you're watching it on an iPhone or an iPad, like, I don't know. There's so many questions I have.
It'd be really funny if it was on an iPad and then, like, they had some malfunctions where they didn't, like, secure it properly and it just smacks you in the face. Like, it just falls. You're like, oh sorry, there, bad run.
A panic button. I wonder if you can bring snacks in there with you, or they could simulate like bugs crawling. Like, I don't know. It's just,
we got a catheter if you need to go to the bathroom.
Okay. So if you're in the Sweden Film Festival circuit this coming weekend, check that out and get back to us. We'd love to hear it about it. Moving on, HBO. I'm very excited. HBO is coming with a horror anthology series called Folklore next month, and for some reason, I have not seen a trailer for this yet.
There's a trailer online. I watched it.
So, is Folklore? Is this like kind of they're tackling all of the Asian horror tropes and stuff like that? Is that?
Yes. Yeah. There's even like a shot that kind of harkens back to like Blair Witch Project. There's like a shot of a guy going inside a house and it has like all those wood witch signs that is from the movie in there. And then, a lot of the images that you would probably recognize from Japanese horror films.
Yeah.
Asian horror films.
Yeah. I'm excited about this because, I mean, I'm a fan of horror. I mean, we both are. That's why we do this show. But it's cool that HBO is getting into foreign horror, and it's cool to see that they're doing this. So I guess there'll be, what, is it 30 or 60 minutes each? Do you know, for each episode? I'm trying to remember. I don't remember.
I don't see anything on the articles that I've looked at. The only information I know is that it just premieres on February 1st. So, there's 6 episodes, and according to like the actual information that was given out, it's going to take place across multiple Asian countries, and each episode is based on each country's deeply rooted superstitions and myths.
Cool. I'm excited. It's Korea, Malaysia, Singapore, Indonesia, and Japan and Thailand.
Yeah.
Very excited. So we will probably be talking about one of these every week starting February in February.
Yeah.
So, and hopefully it does
so
well.
You can, let's do this. You watch that one. Let me know how it is. Cause I do want to see it. I did like the trailer and I did like what I saw and read. But there's another horror anthology that's been out, but it's, the next chapter. And it's on Hulu, which I have. I do not have HBO Go or HBO Now, whatever it's called. Into the Dark. Have you seen any of these?
I have not seen Into the Dark.
I haven't either, but I love the idea of it. I've seen a couple of reviews, and they've been probably around 60%. So the idea is that they release a new episode each month, and it's like tied to something from that month. So the new episode that's coming out for February, also on February 1st, will be centered around Valentine's Day. And so there's a trailer out, and it's called Into the Dark, Down. And you get, if you watch the trailer, you get kind of like a devil vibe, that M. Night Shyamalan film that he wrote or produced. And it's about like these two, this couple that I believe they work together. And so it kind of starts off in like a romantic comedy kind of way, and things are going well. They take the elevator down to leave their job to go to, you know, have their Valentine's Day weekend. But the elevator stops, security guard's missing, everybody's gone. There's some hacking or something going on, and then shit just goes south, and they start harming themselves, harming each other, trying to figure out what's going on. And it just looks like an insane thing that just progresses, like just gets worse and worse. And so that premise has me intrigued. It was put on my radar by a local PR person who said that they're going to be sending me something from the film to advertise on my Instagram. And so I looked into it, and it just seems like something that's right up my alley. And so I like the idea of a horror anthology, just playing with the different months. Because my wife and I even had a conversation about, I wonder if they're going to start doing like TV shows where, and they have, but when they release them like once a month to kind of amp you up and figure out like, whoa, what are they going to do next time? And so given that this is horror and an anthology and it's going to be releasing one each month, I'm intrigued. So I'm going to try to catch up and then dive into this one. So into the Dark on Hulu, or Into the Dark Down.
Cool.
On Hulu.
Very cool. No, I like that. It's that is really good. Really good stuff. I'm going to check that out, and I've got to get you HBO so you can watch this stuff, Preston. We'll talk about that later.
Yeah. Well, the price of Netflix and Hulu and all my subscriptions are going up, especially now that I have a 4K TV. And so it's, so I got to be very selective. So if you say it's good, we're checking out, I will definitely watch it.
Cool. All right. Moving on. I think we have one more thing. There's movies available right now on DVD, Blu-ray, and 4K. What are you thinking? What's coming out?
So I guess to jump genres, but still they're bloody. They're action, sci-fi. Some, you know, people get shot. There's blood in it, so it still counts.
It still counts, man.
I mean, we've even focused like on what was that? Surf Nazis. Like that, you know, that movie has blood in it, but it's not necessarily horror, but. So anything that just celebrates genre films. So I wanted to focus on Arrow's release of Waterworld. did you get this?
You know what? I didn't. I've got to call my Arrow contact because I definitely wanted that.
I got it. And man, it is such an immaculate release. It's got like that thick box look and really cool art, but on the inside it has three different cuts of the film. And my wife has never seen the Waterworld with Kevin Costner. It came out in 1995. It's notorious for being a very expensive movie that just flopped at the box office, but it just has found a cult following because of probably its ties to or I guess its resemblance to a Mad Max film, just on the water. And so the stories about global warming, the ice caps melt, the whole world becomes water. And Kevin Costner plays like this guy who's like kind of evolved. He has like fish gills. And so when I explained that to my wife, she's like, so what makes him so special? And I was like, well, he's got fish gills. he can go underwater and he just knows things. He's just as isolated and by himself, just like Max is in Mad Max. And so super fun movie. I used to love it as a kid. But yeah, this Arrow release has three different cuts of the film. So it has the theatrical cut, which is like 136 minutes long, or 135 minutes long. And then the other discs are the TV cut. And the TV cut, believe it or not, has more footage that was not included in the film. So that jumps up the runtime to 176 minutes. And the cut that I watched, because I've watched the theatrical cut, I've watched the TV cut many, many years ago, but I wanted to watch this new cut, which is the longest of them all, not by much, just 2 minutes longer than the TV cut. So it's 178 minutes long, and it's the Ulysses cut, which is like the European version. It includes previously censored shots and dialogue. And what's cool about it is, compared to like some of the extended cuts and director's cuts that you get from Scream Factory, like The Exorcist, I think we've talked about it before, like you can tell what's new based on the film grain, the film color, because back then a lot of those deleted scenes were just thrown away and they were backed up on secondary drives, they're like secondary prints of the film, so they weren't their best. This movie looks incredible if you have a 4K TV, and man, I just completely forgot like just how great this movie is. I mean, it's got its dumb moments, like any like action film does, but it's just super enjoyable and really good story, great villain. Dennis Hopper plays the villain, and he's just hamming it up as a bald guy who loses his eye in the movie and is trying to find like all these sneaky ways to try to retrieve this girl who from Napoleon Dynamite and a movie that I used to watch a lot as a kid, Andre, which is like Lassie but with a seal.
Right.
And this girl has a tattoo of on her back that is essentially a map to dry land. And so that's what the obsession of this world is, trying to find dry land, trying to sell dirt. Like that's how they make their living, is trading and selling each other things, Mad Max.
I feel like everyone saw this movie at one point in time. And I feel like Waterworld is a product of its time being released, because I think if it was released now, I think it would do super well, because I think people are into all, the Game of Thrones and all the weird shit. Think it would do really well and people would like it. But back then, everybody hated it. It was a huge box office flop.
Yeah. It's crazy because, like movies like Blade Runner, they just didn't do well for the time because they were ahead of their time. Even the movie that we're going to talk about today, Screamers, which is also a Philip K. Dick adaptation, which Blade Runner is too. And so, it's just a lot of these great films that are being put out through Arrow, Scream Factory, all those home distribution companies that we really love. They were like just movies that didn't do super well at their time, but they were so ahead of their time. And they resonate even more today, and Waterworld is definitely one of those films.
Yeah, no, good. I'm glad you brought that up. Because
yeah.
It's one of those films. I think it would do super well today. Are there any other things before we move on to questions?
Yeah. There was the one that you and I were briefly talking about beforehand, before we started recording, Stallone's Cobra, which you reviewed. So, we should talk a little bit about that. I had never seen this film before, but I am a George P. Cosmatos fan, even though... as the extras pointed out, as you were saying before we recorded, not a lot of people enjoyed working with him, but I like movies like Leviathan and films like that. And so
Tombstone.
I just
he did Tombstone.
Was down for it. And, yeah. And the cover art alone, just seeing Stallone all oiled up with sunglasses and a Uzi in hand and gloves and a V-neck, just captured my attention right away. And so, yeah, watched it. It's a pretty standard 80s action flick.
Lots of homoeroticism in it, for sure.
Yeah. a lot of those, like, bad things that are about from the 80s that are just charming today. Like, just like bad one-liners that are goofy and just certain character decisions and villain characteristics that you can just know, like the back of your hand, and they just pop up. Stallone having a sex scene with the woman that he's trying to protect in the film.
the 9 foot like tall Bridget Nielsen.
It just checks the boxes, all those boxes, negative boxes.
Yeah, but it's a movie that you have to watch, because I mean it's gained a cult following, because I mean the movie itself is just not great, but it's so good it's bad, it's so bad it's good, because the it's all over the top, it's ridiculous, like the outfits. I mean, I went into my when I wrote the review, I was like, okay, so you got this guy named Marianne and Cobretti, and he goes by Cobra, which is basically a giant angry snake. And his outfit consists of form-fitting jeans, gigantic sunglasses, and he always has a toothpick in his mouth. And he's after...
Or a match.
Yeah, he's after this cult that are leather-wearing bike riders who do dance routines with axes, basically. And it's
and they're terrible at hitting their targets. They hit other stuff.
Yes, but it's super. It's more funny than scary. But the whole thing is like, I guess Sylvester Stallone is a cop, but he's just. He does not care for the law. It's just like, I'm going to kill anybody.
He holds a court on the streets.
Yes. And it's really fun, but it's violent. It's great.
It's got some really good action scenes in it too, or at least action shots. I don't know. Like, the editing of it is kind of weird, but it's fun at the same time. Like, there'll be, because, you know, he has this Uzi and they do shots whenever there's like a Uzi shot. There's no wide, not a lot of wides, or if there is a wide, it's super quick, but it'll just show shots of a close-up of him shooting his Uzi, which I imagine he probably just sat there for like 30 minutes shooting blanks at the camera, and they just cut it into the film in different places.
Yes.
there's some really good shots in there. He does some like canted Dutch angles that are really fun, like where he just like, turns the camera slightly on its side during certain movements. And then there's the great scene where the Brian Thompson, the villain, AKA Buffalo Bob.
yes.
From Joe Dirt.
Yes.
Where he drives this van into the wall to kill this security cop, police officer guy. And man, it just looks like he annihilated that guy. So yeah, there's some good stuff in it. It's probably like a 3 out of 5. Kind of movie, but pretty enjoyable. Some, as you said, some really good interviews that are just completely honest and truthful.
Yeah, so everybody is super honest in all the new interviews, and then there's like there's no Sylvester Stallone anywhere in the extra, so don't expect that. And then there's the old commentary track by the director George, which is so terrible that you have to listen to it and laugh at it, because He literally just narrates what's happening on screen. It's like, okay, here comes the motorcycle. The sun's
like
coming
Arnold.
Up. Here's birds flying by, and it's literally that for an hour and a half. You're just like, oh God, what's happening? But yeah, still, it's worth getting. I mean, this is like a must own for film fans because, ironically, the movie's about like a crazy cult like thing, and it has a cult following. And it's worth your time for sure if you want to have a good time watching the first of many crazy action films of Sylvester Stallone. Because by this time, by Cobra, when it came out, he had done 4 Rocky movies and 2 Rambo movies already. So he was already pretty popular.
He was the highest paid actor at the time.
Yeah, so but I think Cobra was his first big action movie, like crazy over the top action movie. You know, because the next movie he made was indeed called Over the Top. So it just goes from there. So yes, good stuff, Preston. I like it. Scream Factory, Cobra, and Arrow Video,
Waterworld.
Correct. All right. Are we ready for?
There's one more that I want to do really fast, and it's also a Scream Factory, or not Scream Factory. It's a Shout Select film called Suburbia. That came out in 1983, not to be confused with the lesser-known Richard Linklater film that came out post Days Confused, also called Suburbia, which I watched last year and was not impressed by. I think that's his worst movie. But anyway, Suburbia is directed by Penelope Spheres. She did a movie that I got to interview her for at the Oak Cliff Film Festival because they did like a 30th anniversary screening of her film Dudes with John Cryer. And she's just very infused with the punk scene, especially of the 80s. So she did this great documentary series, the what is it called? Western Civilization. But
Decline
really
of Western Civilization, yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
They're great. But she's made some like narrative versions of those films that tap into some of those themes that she got found real people talking about their stories. And Suburbia was her first narrative film. And there's like nobody in it that you would really recognize today. But there is Flea in it. It's Flea's first movie. He's very young and goofy and enjoyable. He has like a pet rat in the film. So it's about like all these neglected kids who are punks, and they band together and create their own family, a la Fast and Furious. And so, they just go, it's just kind of capturing the mundaneness of their lives, squatting in a house that's abandoned and, going to punk shows and letting out all their frustrations and, creating chaos. But ultimately what's, gravitated or got me to watch, or got me really into the film more than just, am I going to watch this movie? And is it just going to be kids creating anarchy the entire time? No, there's like humanity and heart to it. Like all these kids, you get to kind of see where they come from and understand their frustrations, and all they just need is a home. And they didn't get the love or appreciation from their family. So, and that's a common theme that you'll see in her documentary series. So I got to interview her for this Shout Select release that's coming out next week on January 29th, and had a really fun conversation with her talking about those exact themes. And so it was a movie that I really wanted to highlight. It does have some fight scenes, which is great because I watched the commentary, and she worked with Roger Corman, and his advice was to include a action scene or a fight scene every 10 to 15 minutes. And so her commentary is just so great, and that's going to be the focus of my article that I write that'll be coming out Friday or this weekend.
Where can they catch that talk?
What's up?
Where can they catch it? That talk?
You can find it on, it'll just be in written form, but it'll be on freshfiction.tv and dittonrc.com, Ditton Record Chronicle. So, yeah, you can look up all that stuff and where we talk about her just complete honesty that in her audio commentary, which is just great, more so than George P., who was just, you know, as you said, just being very matter of fact. But, yeah, so Suburbia, 1983, has Flea, punk rockers, creating chaos, truthful and honest, one to look out for.
Very cool. I like it. Are we ready for my bloody questions?
Indeed, indeed.
All right, we had a good time this week with my bloody questions. It's a fun one. We posted it to Reddit, and we got a bunch of comments, so we'll read those as well as give you our own. The question, the bloody question this week is, if you can insert Tom Hanks into any horror movie role, which would it be and why? Preston, the floor.
What's yeah.
my answer?
Well, it's funny. There's, you know, the first thing that pops into my mind is, of course, David S. Pumpkins from SNL, and some people on the Reddit brought that up as well. But then another immediate thought was him playing Norman Bates in Psycho. I just believe that he could do it, especially if you like insert his. How young he is and like big or something like that and put him into that film, I think he would have just knocked it out of the park. But to kind of go along with his urination fascination, as they say, because he likes to piss a lot in his movies or have pee problems. the first movie that came to mind was Trolls 2, because there's the scene in the film where the little kid is he has to his grandfather, who just like pops in and out to tell him what to do, tells this little kid to you need to stop your family from eating the stuff that's going to cause them to, you know, turn into the goopy stuff. So how he does it is he stands on the table and pisses on the table. And so I just thought if could see a very super young Tom Hanks, he would have killed it as the kid in that film that whines the entire time and then pisses on the table.
It would be, I'm in. I'm totally in for that.
But what? If he was in that movie, he would not have the career that he has today.
True. That is very true. All right. I like that one. Mine is, you know, he's not really known for his horror roles, but I actually liked him to see him play Otis Driftwood in Devil's Rejects and House of a Thousand Corpses from Rob Zombie. I love Bill Moseley in that role, but I'd love to see Tom Hanks just completely go on these diatribes that Bill Moseley's done. Like, total block! Total block! I would just love him to do these lines, and I think it'd be so much fun and so sadistic to see Tom Hanks do it. But that's that was my my contribution. But let's go to Reddit. There's some really funny ones. The top one from Super Doodle Bear says Tom Hanks as Pennywise the Clown, which that could be fun. He says, imagine his charming laugh echoing out of a sewer as you walk by. which would be fun. Pennywise does try to lure people in, and Tom Hanks is America's most beloved actor. This totally works, says TYSC3. So, yeah, I like that. I like that. Like Preston said, Movie Mike 007 says a young Tom Hanks as Norman Bates. Apple Pie 1999 says the captain in Event Horizon, which I guess would be Lawrence Fishburne's character, but only if he does it talking like Forrest Gump. Seriously, I think he would be awesome voice or no.
I mean, there's a lot of movies that I would love to see his Forrest Gump in.
Yeah, oh, yeah, like Goodfellas. Hanks is David S. Pumpkins in the style of Terrifier, if you've seen that on Netflix. That's from TYSC3. VBS Official said, this might be the most brilliant thing ever thought of. Congrats on your genius level IQ. which I think is pretty funny. Book of Ebon said Tom Hanks in The Shining, and I got to thinking, I was like, holy shit, I'm digging that. I would love to see Tom Hanks play kind of like, because like when Jack Nicholson did it, he did such a good job, but Jack Nicholson, even before he went crazy in that role, was kind of scary. But I think Tom Hanks could play that good family guy. And
just completely 180 in the film.
Oh, yes. Oh, man, it would be super scary. Just, oh, it would be, I think it'd be awesome. Matt's Thy Wit said Ash from Evil Dead, because it'd be hysterical to see Tom Hanks get tormented, which, holy shit, yes. I mean, I said someone needs to do it. I think it'd be great to have a director with enough balls to just fuck with Tom Hanks throughout the whole movie, like Sam Raimi did with Bruce Campbell. Just throw tons of blood on him and just knock him down. I think that'd be great, don't you think?
Yeah.
Viking 1976 had a funny one. He should play himself and be revealed as the true form of the monster in It Follows 2.
That one was my favorite that I read. That'd be great.
That would be super funny.
He's like, it's like Snowpiercer. Like I am the author of this whole thing. Just him being the first person that kind of created it.
Oh, it's so good. Wizard Nifty says the scene in the witch in the goat pen. I want Tom Hanks to play the thing in there. Which, what is he playing? Is he playing Black Phillip or is he playing the actual devil?
I guess he would be delivering the thou like the taste of butter and live deliciously, all that.
That would be super awesome, actually. I did deliciously.
I'm just picturing like Woody from Toy Story saying all these lines. it would totally throw the tone off of the film.
You're a toy.
You're not a witch. You're an action figure.
Oh, that's funny. Corbin Cream says Dr. Heater in The Human Centipede, which I like that. I would like to see, just because Dr. Heater played like he was very calculated and cold and very quiet in the first Human Centipede. But in part three, his character goes to being a warden, which is very over the top, loud, and obnoxious. So I could see that. One of my favorite ones, though, comes from The Crow Show, which I know The Crow Show personally. He comes to Fantastic Fest, and he's an amazing, amazing man in Canada. But he said, Tom Hanks is Buffalo Bill in Silence of the Lambs. Imagine him tucking his dick between his legs and also telling himself, I would fuck me hard. He'd knock it out of the park. And I read that comment this morning, and I was like, oh, this day is amazing already. It's the biggest smile on my face, and I just think Tom Hanks playing Buffalo Bill, oh, I just want to see this right now, don't you?
Yeah. I mean, that commenter saying just beloved, most beloved actor, like that is just a hard thing to picture, but man, it would be miraculous to see.
It would. I mean, just to hear Tom Hanks deliver those lines and do the tuck in and then it puts the lotion on this. It'd be so good. The Crow Show, we have to mention, he's really into horror movies too. We got to have him on this podcast. He does a live show on Twitch under The Crow Show. You should check that out. It's pretty cool. I love that. Some other ones, The Cook in The Texas Chainsaw Massacre. The Killer and Stepfather. Desperate in Ireland said the house that Tom built. LOL. Not the house that Jack built, the house that Tom built, which is really funny if you've seen that movie.
Yeah. Like him being like something like Urban Legend, where, you know, you find out who the killer is at the end, but it's revealed to be like, it's legit Tom Hanks. And he just says like, I was just bored. So just, here I am, killing
here,
people.
Here I am. He needs to do it. The Tall Man in Phantasm, which would be kind of cool. Tom Hanks is Dracula, which I think would be a funny Dracula, but nonetheless Dracula. And then Tom Hanks as Carrie from Not Defective. So, yeah.
Speaking of something that you just said with Tom Hanks playing the tall man, there's like this thing going on that is trying to get Michael Shannon to play the tall man in a Phantasm reboot.
Because Michael Shannon is indeed like 7 foot tall.
Yeah. And he'd be perfect.
Yes, yes, he is. And I also would like to mention before we get to bloody recommendations, because it would be a recommendation. However, I have not seen it yet. But our good friend from Fantastic Fest this past year, Daniel Gilchrist. You remember Daniel, right?
Yeah.
He's an actor and he's been in a bunch of movies. He was in a movie actually at Fantastic Fest. But his big movie that he was working on is finally out right now, and I'm just so happy about it. It is called Beast of the Water, and it is available on Amazon Prime. You can pick it up at Target, Best Buy, Barnes & Noble's, iTunes, Walmart, and Redbox. But it's called Beast of the Water, and it is a horror movie about a giant monster, and Daniel plays the actual monster in the movie. So it's called Beast of the Water. Preston, I think for next week we will have to watch this and talk about it. And I think we can probably get Daniel on the podcast.
Okay. Sounds cool.
So yeah, that is, I think, we have to mention, that, for sure to tell people, but, that is our bloody question. If you have any more, you can find it on Reddit, or you can email us at mybloodypodcast@gmail.com and let us know what movies Tom Hanks should be in horror-wise. So we would love to hear from you. Moving on to My Bloody Recommendations, where we give recommendations of horror movies, old or new, that you might have not seen, but we want to suggest you watch these because they're great. Preston, what's your recommendation this week? I think I know what your recommendation is. I haven't seen it.
Yeah, I spoiled it, yeah. So, full disclosure, I first saw this a few years ago at South By at its world premiere, and it was a movie that James Cole Clay, who saw it with me, and I did not like that much. I think it might have been the same year that we all saw, it might have been the year before, but there was a year that we went to South By where we were just completely underwhelmed by everything, most of the stuff that we saw. And it could have just been a mood or a time. So I don't know. I went into this movie and I was just ready to hate it. I don't know why I was like that, but I revisited it with my wife a few days ago, and because this director, his name is Todd Strauss Schultzen, his new movie, Isn't It Romantic, is coming out Valentine's Day weekend this year, and it has Rebel Wilson in it, and it's that movie, real quickly, is just about a woman who falls into like a romantic comedy movie and then just kind of playing around with all those tropes and all those different things that you would expect to happen, like a typical romantic comedy. This movie, The Final Girls, is a film that's pretty essentially the horror version of that particular scenario. And so it's something that I've often wondered, you know, when you watch like something like Friday the 13th, which this movie is heavily kind of based on. The killer has a machete and has a mask, and kids counselors go into a camp and by the lake, and they traumatize the kid and he becomes the killer of the movie. Except that scenario, like that thing, is a movie within the movie. So it's made to be a terrible 80s film that everybody just like loves and watches and it's been out for like 20 years and they're doing like an anniversary screening. But on top of that, more than just it being like a movie that is like a horror comedy, kind of like Cabin in the Woods, or Behind the Mask, that kind of plays around with all those things that you would, all those horror ingredients. It focuses on a mother and daughter relationship, and the mother is played by Malin Ackerman. You'd recognize from Watchmen and films like that. She plays the mother, and she was Nancy. And so a lot of these names that pop up in this movie within the movie, which is called, God, it's Camp something. I'm blanking on it.
Sleepaway Camp, like, Camp Nowhere.
Yeah, something like that. Camp Killer, Camp Slash, I don't know, something like that. Can't recall, sorry. But all the characters' names in those films, in that film, is based off of other character names from other iconic horror films, like Nancy, you know, Nightmare on Elm Street, Tina, also Nightmare on Elm Street, but and they pop up in like Halloween and other things like that. But so Malin Ackerman plays the mom, and so 20 years later, after that movie came out, she's like going to auditions and kind of tapping into like the struggle of a horror actress that was beloved back in the day, but is not being put in good movies today and is just really struggling. So that's just bringing a level of truth that I was not anticipating upon revisit. I don't know if I was just bird boxing it during the first time I watched it, but just how it went. And the daughter in the film is played by Tessa Farmiga, who we talked about in The Nun not too long ago. And so she is, they just have a loving, nice relationship, and they're like talking in this car ride, and you're getting a sense of their relationship together, or their relationship, and they're listening to like great 80s music. What's the song? The song, I can like hum it. It's you. God damn it. What is that name of that song? I'm going to have to look it up. I'm going to look it up while I talk. So, there's a car accident and it kills the mother. The daughter survives. And then we, you know, jump 3 years later. And the daughter is living with her aunt, and her friends invite her, or one friend in particular invites her to an anniversary screening of the movie that her mother was in. And she doesn't want to go, all this stuff, but then just, you know, they have like a heart to heart conversation saying like, it'd be great to have you there. And so this is tapping into like the great feelings that you get when you go to a anniversary screening or a screening of a horror film, like at the Alamo or wherever you go to your local theater, when they have like screenings of like The Shining or something. And then you're in there, you're shouting all the lines and having a good time. So that's like celebrating that. But where the premise really comes into play is, a series of events happen, like Final Destination, where it just causes this thing to happen, which is all her friends. So the daughter and her friends get sucked into this 80s movie, into the movie that her mother's in. And so the theater like burns down, like a kid has a cigarette, you know, a bottle of vodka drops, whatever, causes the theater to burn. And then so the theater's locked. They can't get out. So they use a prop of a machete that was lying on the ground, and they cut into the screen. And then these like five group of friends go into the movie. And so they wake up in a forest and they see and we've seen at this point, like the quote iconic clips from the film to know like what to anticipate, because they do like a little trailer before the movie begins. And so we see the kids in like this old Volkswagen van come around the corner, and they're like, "Hey," and they see these group of kids, and they say, "Do you know where Camp blah 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 is?" And they're like, they're just completely dumbfounded and stuck in their track like a deer in the headlights, don't know what to say. And so the car just drives on, and they're like, okay. And so 90 minutes later, because, you know, horror movies kind of hit around 90 minutes, it happens again. So they're just stuck in this loop where the movie just happens over and over again. And I should say some of the kids or some of the people that are in the movie itself, Adam Devine from Workaholics, some of the other characters that play the kids themselves, Alexander Ludwig, Nina Dobrev, and Alicia Shawkat, that you know from Arrested Development. And then Thomas Middleditch. He's like the horror aficionado that knows like what to anticipate and all that sorts of stuff. So he's the guy from Scream. They slowly realize that they have to like survive the movie and help these characters survive the movie. And on top of that, you know, you have the daughter kind of reconnecting with her mother, but you know, the mother's playing a character and she's in complete character. And so that's just bringing like this whole warm feeling to the movie that I recognized when I saw it the first time, but it just amplified or it just like hit me even harder this time. So just that relationship is what drives this movie and what the movie is really about. And then it, on top of that, the icing on the cake is just that they're having all these jokes playing with like tropes and all the negative things that happen in movies, all the stereotypes and all the stuff. Like you have like the girl that just takes her clothes off all the time and stuff like that. So it's a lot of fun. Yeah, just a really heartfelt and really funny movie that for some reason I just was not given it a chance when I first saw it. And I think it had to deal with, cause Cole and I were sitting next to the cast members, and usually it's hard to gauge like what movie will be good to watch in a film festival setting. Most of the time I would think in most cases, I would think a movie like this would play very well for a film festival. For some reason, it wasn't clicking for me at the time, but you know, I watched The Guest at a film festival and just had a hell of a time because everybody was just laughing, hooting, hollering. And maybe because they're like hooting and hollering in the film, I just didn't need that extra layer. I don't know. Yeah, this movie for some reason has just been under the radar and nobody's like highlighted it despite its great cast and a great premise. And so I hope maybe after Isn't It Romantic comes out that maybe this film will find a new life, because it's really great. And Brian, I really think you should see it. You'd have a hell of a time, especially since we enjoy movies like Behind the Mask and Cabin in the Woods and stuff like that, that kind of break down and deconstruct horror films. And so it just celebrates everything that we talk about on the show and pokes fun at it too. So good. Very enjoyable.
The yeah, I'm going to have to give it a shot. I haven't seen it yet. One horror movie that I have not seen. And I get when you said you sat next to the cast at the screening this last year at Fantastic Fest, something similar happened. And I started talking my big mouth, not knowing that the cast was there for this movie. And it was a great movie. It's called, Bloodline with Sean William Scott. Walk into the movie and I just yell, I just like say out loud, "God damn, I hope this movie's not 3 hours long." And not knowing one of the cast members and producers is like, "It's not." And I was like, "Oh no." It turns out that it was them. I was like, "Oh no."
Feel awkward. Yeah.
It's awkward. I love the movie though.
Yeah, we were just sitting next to like the cast members and they were just laughing and they were with their friends and family. And you know, when this particular screening was at the Paramount at South by Southwest, and that's like the big 1200 seated theater. And so there's a lot of people in there. And when you go to film festivals, whether the movie's good or bad, like the audience will make it seem like every movie's good. And that's why we call it festival goggles. When we go to movies, a lot of the reviews you kind of have to take with a grain of salt, is because they are just coming off of that energy, and right. It probably sways their opinion. And then when they revisit it later, it's like, ugh, that was just shit. But this was the complete opposite. And so I've been meaning to rewatch it for the longest time. And so I just straight up bought it, because it's just been sitting on the shelf for a while at my local movie trading co. And so I traded some stuff in, got it, and rewatched it, and just had a really good time. And so I'm really looking forward to Isn't It Romantic? And so, Final Girls, The Final Girls. Don't be confused with another movie called Final Girl. So The Final Girls came out in 2015.
All right. You got to do it. All right. My bloody recommendation of the week is the complete opposite of The Final Girls.
Yeah.
My bloody recommendation comes from the year 1926.
Holy shit.
Holy shit is right. The movie, you've probably heard about it. I don't know if you've ever seen it, but they've made tons of remakes of this movie. But the movie is called Faust, F-A-U-S-T, from 1926. 1 year before Metropolis, the famous movie Metropolis, changed the filmmaking landscape forever. There is a little horror film known as Faust came out, and it shocked the world. Before Metropolis, this Faust movie was actually the most expensive movie ever made and took so long to shoot due to the director, F.W. Murnau, who did Nosferatu, his need for perfection. It was basically like a very early Stanley Kubrick production, with hundreds and hundreds of takes being done in one single shot. That's kind of what Faust is. But the story of Faust, you probably heard about it. It's been around as early as maybe the 1400s. But this is one of the first adaptations of the story on film, which is, I would say, intense, sadistic, scary, and at some times a little funny. Again, many filmmakers and creators have adapted this story many, many times into movies, TV series, stage plays. Most recently in 2011, there was a movie version that actually did a pretty good job with it. But it all comes back to this 1926 silent version, which is actually pretty cool. If you don't know the story about it, it's about a man who makes a deal with the devil, or, you know, some big demon. Basically, sin and redemption. Mephisto is this demon who has a wager with an angel that he can morally corrupt anyone, and if he wins, he can rain his darkness upon Earth forever. That's where this guy comes in. His name is Faust, and he's a good man, but he is swayed by the demon into temptation through love, lust, murder, and other things. And what Murnau shows in Faust's transformation, it's just perfect, and without sound, no less. It really is a good work of art. Old school, 1926. It is a stepping stone for all of horror. If you have not seen it, I highly suggest you watch it. It is excellent. It's from Kino Lorber Classic Blu-rays. It is on Blu-ray. Looks great. It actually comes with a piano score in stereo sound, and there's special features. There's an hour-long documentary about the making of the film with interviews from tons of people that goes into the chaos that was the production of this movie. There are screen tests and more through the extras, but it is called Faust. It's about $15 for Blu-ray. Yeah, and I would highly suggest you get it. And also, if you purchase this Kino one, you will get the Blu-ray and the DVD version of it all in one. But yes, I would highly recommend this 1926 version of Faust.
Well, to be honest, most of the time when it comes to films like that old, and you've recommended a silent film on here before, I'm very young, and as they say, I have an attention span of a gnat. And so I think the best way for me to get into just straight up dive, I don't think I could straight up just dive into this movie, but I could probably watch that documentary first to kind of provide a little bit of an appetizer to get me into it and learn the history behind it. Because that's what's fascinating about a lot of these old films I've been watching lately, is just kind of see the makings and the history of it. That gets me into the mindset of watching it as an audience member at the time of its release and just being like just in complete shock and awe that you're seeing makeup like this for the first time and effects and production design. And so if I just dove into it right now, I'd just be like, bored. But I really think if I watched the documentary first, that would get me to watch it.
Or shit, just come over, man. We'll watch this. We'll have some scotch. We'll have some whiskey. We'll have some fucking food.
Yeah,
and we'll
or
watch
you could do it
shit
that way.
Or we could do it that way. But yeah, I highly suggest watching this. The extra you're talking about is called The Language of Shadows. Maybe cool. That might be on YouTube or something that you could watch, but it's about an hour long, and the extra was made in 2007. So, you know, it's got a lot of really cool stuff to it, but yeah, The Language of Shadows is that extra, which you would probably want to watch, for that. But yeah, Faust, 1926, for you horror fans, start there. Good stuff. But we got to go to our main event, Screamers from 1995. Preston's best friend in the world, Peter Weller, stars, yo. Screamers is a movie from 1995, directed by Christian Duguay. I guess that's how you pronounce his name.
Yeah.
He directed, like, TV movies of Scanners 2 and 3. He did not a whole lot of other movies, but the main thing here is that Dan O'Bannon wrote the screenplay. And who is Dan O'Bannon, you might say? Well, holy shit. He wrote Alien, the first Alien movie. He wrote Dead and Buried, right? He wrote
Total
Heavy
Recall.
Metal, Total Recall. He wrote and directed the first Return of the Living Dead. I mean, the dude is awesome. So he wrote this movie, and it is based on Philip K. Dick's novel Second Variety, which if you ever read any Philip K. Dick stuff, you would know that like a lot of it's set in the future, and it deals with like society, societal changes and weird shit politically, as well as possibly a lot of machines or robots turning on their owners in a post-apocalyptic kind of landscape. But the plot of the film, in a nutshell, I know Preston will go into it a little more, but it's set in the future, and there is this planet that is a mining planet in
2078.
Yes, 2078. And this there is this planet where there's a war between a big corporate mining company and called New Economic Bloc, and then against the Alliance, who are a group of former mining and science personnel. So basically, this war has kind of come to a stalemate, and that is where the main guy in the movie, Commander Joseph Hendrickson, played by Peter Weller, comes in, and he is part of the Alliance, and basically, he hears from Earth and other people like, oh, they want a truce. We're going to go to the New Economic Bloc and try to find peace. But then shit happens, and I'll let Preston kind of go into that. But that's kind of the story. But we're dealing with, like, clones and robots and all sorts of weird stuff here. But, Preston, what do you think?
Yeah, so movie begins, it begins kind of like Blade Runner, where it has text to kind of inform you as to what's going on. And that's the fascinating element, just like all the backstory behind the film and how they got there. It's kind of like, you know, in a mainstream action, you would get all of that stuff in the movie and then you'd be like, okay. But this one, it causes the mind to wander and be even more curious as to what's going to happen here, because you're just thrown right into it all. You're just supposed to accept this world as it is, what's going on, where we are in the future. And as you were alluding to, Brian, a lot of stuff that Philip K. Dick talks about in the short stories and novels that he's put out. As Peter Weller quoted in my interview, he said that it's a lot of stuff that Philip K. Dick writes about is about the progression of mankind and how that progression gets bitten in the bud and by mankind's lack of compassion. And so what's even cooler about Philip K. Dick's work is that he takes stuff from the past, like classic stories or stories that one of the things that I talked about with Peter Weller in a recent interview was he says there's a particular story about slaves, and then that kind of comes into Total Recall and Blade Runner. Like there's, you know, certain amount of people that they're trying to track down. And so it's just fascinating to kind of get into Philip K. Dick's world and just how he saw it for the 1950s, the 1960s. Like it's just insane some of the stuff that he saw or that he was envisioning in something that he painted or illustrated in his novels. And so, yeah, Screamers. As you said, you know, it's a battle between miners and essentially the energy company. And so the Alliance created these little automatons, that these little robot things that protect them. And they're essentially like a mixture between tremors that they burrow underground. And then like the effects of the film kind of look like a tremors coming towards you. Like the dirt is just like thrown in the sand, wherever it's being thrown in the air. And that kind of makes you feel terrified. But what makes it terrifying is that they're nicknamed Screamers because they have this high-pitched scream. And like the chrome ball from Phantasm has these saw blades and blades on it that can take off your head, take off your arm, just completely rip you to shreds. But these Screamers have evolved over time, and and they have a mind, a conscience of their own, something that we've seen in a lot of movies lately, you know, Age of Ultron, Transcendence, whatever, where artificial intelligence, Blade Runner, you know, all the stuff that Philip K. Dick did, of artificial intelligence just turning on mankind and wanting to be the superior being in a way, or quote being. So these little Screamers evolve over time, and at this point, you know, we're getting into the nitty-gritty of the movie. We're spoiling it, so we're hoping that you've seen the movie, and you should see it. So at this point, it's a pretty solid action film. Some of the effects are dated, but like I kind of said with when you were talking about Faust, it's good to get into a movie if you're pretending that you're an audience member watching it from the year that released. So if you're watching in 1995, some of these effects might be pretty good. They use like kind of like RoboCop. So whenever like a robot or something's on screen, it's like stop motion. And then they use some computer effects. And there's like one shot in particular. There's ways that the director could have danced around it, but he's just exposing it. And so, you know, one person gets chopped in half and this person's a robot, and it just looks bad. Like it just does not look good at all. So yeah, if you go in expecting a lot of elements from traditional action sci-fi movies, but this just little undercurrent of knowledge and themes of doom and chaos of what the future could hold. It's just completely fascinating and fun to explore and discuss. And Peter Weller is just great in it. And I'm not just saying it because I have his name or his number on my phone, but
they're best friends. They're best friends.
Yeah. He was just, I guess I'll say the backstory real quick. Sidebar moment. I met him at a Comic-Con convention here in Dallas, back in like 2012 or 2013, I think it was 2012. And he was signing autographs for all his movies, RoboCop, he did a big panel and all that. And so I went up to him and he was wearing a UNT hat, and I was writing for the UNT paper, University of North Texas paper. And I just said, man, I would love to talk to you because, you know, you're wearing this hat and you're a UNT alumni and alumnus, and people just love to hear what you have to say. And to completely shock me, this man is just wicked smart. He's just really – he has, like, all these different degrees. He's a doctor. So he has he's a Renaissance man, just has all this knowledge about Renaissance art. He has a home in Los Angeles. He has a home in Italy. And, man, just to pick this guy's brain is just like sitting down with your grandfather. And it's not because he's old, but because he's just has all this immense, vast knowledge that is just fascinating. And so would love to have him as my teacher, or would have loved to have him as my teacher in college. But so he's teaching me things now. But so, yeah, I interviewed him as he was smoking a cigar in a parking lot with my friend. And he was just dropping like all this knowledge on me and talking about RoboCop, talking about Denton, Denton, Texas, where I grew up. And that's where UNT is located. So got to talk to him about what the town was like back when he went to school. And he was telling me stories about, you know, there was nothing really to do in Denton because it was a dry town in terms of like alcohol and drugs. And so they would have to go to Dallas, 30 minutes south, to get loaded up. And so just like all that stuff was just super fascinating. And then over time, because I got his email and phone number, anytime like a re-release of one of his movies come out, or because right now he directs a lot of stuff. He directed episodes of Sons of Anarchy, and he did Justified and all kinds of shows now. Mayans MC, the Sons of Anarchy spinoff. So the guy's busy. And actually my favorite, hands down favorite episode of Sons of Anarchy is one that he directed, and I didn't know until I looked it up later. And so he's gifted in other areas. And so just was not expecting that. And so, yeah, over time I've Screamers coming out, just hit him up through an email and just say, hey, I'd love to talk to you about this. And as it turns out, Screamers is one of his favorite movies that he's done. He gets asked a lot about RoboCop, and I may have joked on here before, but I know I've joked with Brian that if it comes to RoboCop, he doesn't want to talk about it. You got to pay him handsomely to get him to talk about that. But I was able to talk to him about RoboCop twice, because once he was at that, you know, Comic-Con convention, naturally that's what you got to talk about, because that's the most notable role for him, and for the first original 1987 RoboCop and its sequel. And of course, Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai Across the Eighth Dimension. So those two films, like, he gets asked a lot about, and I know, like, at this point he's been asked to death about it. Don't really need to ask him anything about that, because you can search it and find it online. But so he loves to talk about Screamers in this movie that he did also in the 90s called The New Age. But he loves Screamers because of all the themes and the thing, Philip K. Dick's words. So that's where the fascination for him came from, was so I guess I should start with Dan O'Bannon. Dan O'Bannon, yes, wrote the screenplay back in the 80s. And
it was shelved for a long time, right?
Yeah, 15 years or so, something like that. It was shelved because Blade Runner didn't do well. And the other writer, Miguel, his last name escapes me, but he wrote The Lion King. Or he's one of the writers on The Lion King, the original 94 animated version. The only one.
The only one.
So he wrote The Lion King the year before this movie came out. And so He did rewrites, and then I think the director had a hand in it too. But Peter Weller also had a hand in the rewrites, or at least he instructed. He wanted to bring it more back to Philip K. Dick, and it was kind of developing into like a standard sci-fi. And so when you watch the movie, you get that sense. You get the sense that there's like a traditional sci-fi movie in it, and then there's also like this cerebral, intellectual, high-class sci-fi movie in it, like Blade Runner, where it's just like a thinking man's or thinking person's sci-fi movie. And so if I can be critical of it, that's what you feel, that tug of war going on in the film. Like you can see the elements where it's just like, man, this is deep and smart. And then you'll have another moment where you're like, yeah, this is kind of like something I've seen before. But ultimately, it's still a very good movie. And I really enjoyed the conversation that I had with Peter Weller about it, because he was just dropping all these stories about how there's a shootout in the movie where you realize that there's this young kid in the film, and you think that he's just a sweet, innocent kid, and it turns out he's a robot. And then that's like the big reveal of the movie, is that these screamers have evolved more than we would have ever anticipated. And how they're doing this is, and we get a tease of it, a sampling of it in the beginning of the film, where one guy just gets completely annihilated at the beginning, gets his arm cut off and things like that. That kind of brings in the idea that there's a peace treaty, or like they want peace between these the energy group and the miners. And so this guy gets torn up, and it's the screamers like – starts taking like his limbs and taking it down underground, and then basically just to essentially learn how these screamers can learn how to be more human. And so they use this kid, and it effectively works, because, you know, Peter Weller's character, Hendrickson, and the other guys in the film, they think that he's a real person. And so and then later on we realize that a soldier guy is also a robot, and so it blows your mind even further. And so it's like one of the first, you know, Blade Runner was like one of the first movies to really do it, but it's like before we got this like stampede of artificial intelligence movies about that. Like, this was one of the pioneers, so to speak. But there's, you know, there's plenty of movies before it that kind of dealt with that, but not quite on this level. And so Peter Weller was telling me stories about all that, and how the history of it, and how it came to be, how the movie changed over time, and his introduction of his character. He got to put his own little spin on it and ad lib a lot of the great lines that when I watch it, and because I know how he is, there's like a line in the movie where he says something along the lines of what was it? Like about him like not giving a shit about what this guy has to say. So this guy's like, one character's like rambling, and he's just like, I just like don't give a shit. it's just funny how he just like brought himself into it, because his character like smokes cigars, and he listens to like Mozart, and has this like Egyptian coin that he actually has. Interesting enough.
Would you say he's like Cobra, but in the future?
yeah, pretty close.
Pretty close.
But yeah, when I was talking to him, there's a point in the film where it like comes down to like him and this girl getting in this escape pod to kind of like, like Planet of the Apes, inform the humans as to what's going on, inform Earth as to what's going on. And it's like an Egyptian coin. And so he brought that into the film himself. And he has the coin. He had the coin in his hand as he was talking to me. And it was just insane. So, and then he was telling another great story about there's a shootout in the film, and where the young kid gets shot, which I talked about because I'm like going tangent after tangent here, where the kid gets shot and you realize that he's a robot. So there's a lot of heavy, a lot of bullets just flying everywhere. And so they were shooting in Canada, so like northern Quebec, Montreal, stuff like that. It's like these abandoned places. And it's super cold, below zero out there. And Patagonia donated like all these new scarves and jackets that they could wear in the film as kind of like a trial run as to like, hey, does this keep you warm? And so he wears the scarf in the movie around his head. And so he was listening to Soundgarden on his Walkman while the shootout was going down. And if you've ever watched like any stuff for like RoboCop, he also did that in RoboCop, but he was listening to Peter Gabriel's Red Rain. And there's a shootout in RoboCop at the drug warehouse. And it's just, you know, it's just him just shooting people, but he has that helmet on so he can listen to stuff. And he was listening to Peter Gabriel there. And if you go on YouTube, you can actually like watch that clip where some guy like added the Peter song. Gabriel's Red Rain to the scene. So you could get inside his head as to what he was doing.
Thank you, Internet.
Yeah. So just like fun little things like that. And so, I just really enjoyed talking to him. And he's just a super smart guy. And
so if you don't know Peter Weller yet, he is a super smart guy. And if you've listened to anybody talk about him that he's worked with, they always say like that dude is smart. And actually a lot of the bigger and smarter ideas in this movie came from Peter Weller.
If you watch the extras that are on Shout or Scream Factory's release, I just tuned up, my ears perked up every time they were talking about them working with Peter Weller, because they'll say like he's just like such a serious guy. Like he like the woman that's in the film, she was talking about like how her and her girlfriends or other friends that were on the set, they'd be like joking around, and then Peter Weller would say, you people are lowering my IQ. I need to get away from you guys. And so, and then they said that the woman said that she went over to Peter's house and there's like jazz music playing, and thinking that they were listening to like somebody like super professional, you know, playing a trumpet. And it turns out it was Peter Weller playing the trumpet. So, and they got them like Rolling Stone tickets. It's just like, man, this guy is just has his hands in like everything, and just completely absorbs art like a sponge. And so, after just like talking to him, I'm so glad that he was a part of the movie, not just from an acting standpoint, but he just really steered the story back into it being more of the Philip K. Dick story of just kind of tapping into those more thoughtful themes that we were talking about earlier. So, I can't imagine like how standard this would have been if they had got somebody else. It probably would have been straight to DVD like its sequel is. But I'm glad Shout Factory or Scream Factory's putting this out. And so it's interesting to watch it now. So maybe it'll find new life today. But yeah.
Yeah, it's still a fun movie, because there's like evidence of like even the movie, the Spielberg / Kubrick movie AI with all the robots and the teddy bears, because at the end of the film there's something similar to that. And it's you know, you'd see like, I think a lot of filmmakers, they would not admit it maybe, but would probably draw inspiration from this movie Screamers. And it's 1995, like it's not an 80s movie, it's mid 90s, so I like this movie. It's good. How do I say it? It's not gonna like win any medals or
it's
gold
not
or anything.
Revolutionary or anything like that, but it's just a pretty solid good time. And then when you think about it later, you'll be more fascinated with it. But I could watch like Blade Runner over and over and over and 2049 over and over just because, or especially 2049. It's like a more entertaining version of those elements. But yeah, it'll just be entertaining, and it has like its parts where it can be dumb, and but it's all a part of that kind of, you know, it came out in the mid 90s, but it feels still like it could have came out in the 80s.
Right.
It has that kind of low budget feel, and they use matte paintings, and it looks incredible when they do like little wide shots of the guys walking.
Yeah.
And you get to see like what the world looks like on this planet, Sirius 6B, I believe.
Yeah.
So kind of like Moon, 2009's Moon.
Yes, I like that movie.
You know, they're trying to get resources off another planet, but the other planet, or I guess taking it to a next level in this film, the resources have radiation, so it's high levels of radiation, so that's what's kind of causing this war to happen. So it's just like, it's just a fascinating story. So it's like one of those movies where you watch it and you're like, man, this would be a really good book. And so it turns out this is a short story, so you can read it. So yeah, it's just a good time.
Good. Yeah, I definitely want to check all of this out. As far as, well, when I say I want to check all this out, I want to check out the actual sequel to this movie, because there was a sequel, right?
Yeah, it came out in 2009, and from what I hear, from what people have said, it's not awful. It kind of expands upon the ideas of the first film, and then it even picks up like with the teddy bear that you were alluding to, because the movie ends with, like, you know, going back to Earth, but the teddy bear is one of the screamer things.
Yeah.
And Peter Weller has like a relationship with this teddy bear in the movie, and so it just kind of ends on this, like a lot of good horror films do, where you're like, okay, everything's okay, and then you're like, oh fuck. So it just kind of ends on that way, ends that way. And so from what I hear, it's not that bad, but has that kind of straight to DVD effects and everything. But like I said, like the effects of this one is not too terribly great, but yeah, I'd be curious to check it out.
Well, there you go. Let's see what else. Yeah, I guess that's it. I think that brings an end to our My Bloody podcast this week, which was I think a success. Hopefully, yeah. Right?
Yeah, I think so. All right. I mean, I hope I didn't sound like an asshole saying that I can talk to Peter Weller, but it was just a lucky thing that happened when I was young, and I just really enjoy talking to him, and I guess he enjoys talking to me, and I just know what to ask and what not to ask him, and so I just really respect him. And I mean, I've seen movies and that he's been in that haven't been great, but, and he recognizes it too. He'll tell you, he's like, he made a joke about, he's like, one of my friends said I was in like 95 movies and like 80 of them are just bad or something like that. But I feel like everything that he's been in, and he's honest, he'll just say, you know, I did it for the money, or, you know, I did it because I thought the story was fascinating, like how he got into Star Trek Into Darkness that he was in. He was a fan of the 2009 Star Trek that J.J. Abrams did, and because somebody told him, it's like, hey, I think you would like this, and he'll tell you, and Peter Weller would tell you that he's not a sci-fi guy at all. Like, he just, which is strange. Weird. Because he's in so many sci-fi movies, but when you think about it, a lot of those sci-fi movies have some kind of bigger thing going on that's more than just monsters and, you know, robots. There's more of like a connective tissue there, I guess, that we can relate to, or we can just find fascinating. So Yeah, I just really respect him and enjoy his work, and just looking for any excuse to talk to him. And so this was one of those excuses, and I just had a fun trip down the rabbit hole.
Good deal. Well, that is awesome. And we are My Bloody Podcast. We're on iTunes and Stitcher Radio, Boomstick Comics. Preston can be found all over the world. Where can they find you?
So you can find me on Twitter at Preston Barta, B-A-R-T-A, and you can find me where I'm more active, which is Instagram, where I'm recommending movies pretty much every day, a movie from my physical collection. So I got to post one today. But you can find my writing in video interviews and things like that on freshfiction.tv, where I'm the features editor. And they can also find my stuff on Denton Record Chronicle, or in the Denton Record Chronicle, North Texas newspaper, DentonRC.com. And on DentonRC.com, you can find my written form of my Peter Weller interview, because he was a UNT alumni. So if you'd like to see some more quotes and his intellect, you can go look up that article.
Cool, cool. It's good stuff. Yeah, there you go. That is it. Follow us, love us, like us, smell us.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Email us at mybloodypodcast@gmail.com. You can talk about, email us about our bloody questions, something that we got wrong, or something. If you like us, if you don't like us, I don't care. We'll read it. We're just happy to hear from people, and love to talk about horror. So just email us at mybladepodcast@gmail.com.
There you go. And we'll see you next week. We can't wait.